Hello, and welcome to the Commander Theory Podcast. I'm Nick Beatman, and I'm here with my friend, Zach Kmack.
Hello, theorists.
So today we're going to be discussing how to calibrate your threat assessment to some deck archetypes that have a scarier reputation than they actually deserve. With us to dive into this topic is Valerio, probably better known as Golgari Guy on Twitter. Thanks for joining us, Valerio.
Thanks for having me, guys. Just want to say, like I told you already, I'm a big fan of yours, and I've been following you for like at least 3 years. So I'm really happy to be here.
Well, we really enjoy your takes on Twitter. I think everyone listening to this should probably go follow at Golgari Guy right now. But let's get into the discussion. We've got a deck archetype up on the docket that's very relevant these days with the reintroduction of poison in the standard environment. So let's talk about poison. Poison, I'll admit, I've played a lot of poison over the years, and there are definitely some cards that grant poison counters that have the potential to kill players very quickly. But as someone who knows both the strengths and weaknesses of the archetypes, I'd say that the reaction that poison decks get at many commander tables is often out of proportion to their power level. And I think that a lot of players are having trouble accurately assessing the threat posed by poison. So Valerio, what do you think about poison? You've been talking to your followers and trying to get a reaction from the community. What do you think about what people think is the problem with poison? What are they not factoring in? What's the issue with poison?
Yeah, just before joining podcast, I was asking around on Twitter if anyone had played against some poison or infect deck after the introduction of the new All Will Be One cards. And I'm still getting some, like a lot of comments, to be honest. And people seem to be more or less split up between, a group that is like, yeah, I've been playing around it, and, the new XL commander, like, they rarely win. Maybe they take someone out and they lose. Some people were even saying, oh, like, I enjoy the faster pace that these archetypes bring to games. And others were like, oh, I really hate it. I feel powerless, that I cannot do anything against Proliferate. In particular, I think that the new commander also brings another feature that is that people usually don't like very much, which is stealing cards from the opponent's deck and playing them. So also many people were saying that they perceive this as a problem. And a comment that I get often is that people say like, oh, but like it's not really poison per se that is the problem, but it's Proliferate. It's the fact that you can get, a couple of poison counters at the beginning of the game, and then they will just proliferate them until you die, and you cannot do anything against that, which I think is really interesting, because it's like the issue is the powerlessness, like the feeling that you're powerless and your demise is inevitable, that people seem to take an issue with.
Now that's very interesting, because, I mean, in a lot of ways, your demise is inevitable in a game of Commander. Like, there are always going to be creatures on the board. Like, your life total is going to be significantly lower at the end of the game. Like, and odds are, in a four-player game, you're probably going to lose. So it's really interesting that, like, poison has carved out its the special place in people's brains that, like, gets, I don't know, such a negative reaction compared to the types of losing that we see all the time.
Especially if you think that, like, while it might be true that we don't have many cards that can deal with poison counters, unless you want to run leeches in your deck, I guess, people usually don't just run life gain in their deck unless they have some synergy with it. So, like, if you feel powerless and you say, oh, but I have no card to find infect, then do you run life gain in your other decks just to fight normal damage? And I think people don't do it unless they have life gain synergies.
Yeah, and also, like, infect does operate really similarly to commander damage, which has been in the format basically since the beginning, in that, like, you can't reduce commander damage you've already taken. It will, if you keep getting hit, it doesn't matter how much life you gain, you will die to it. So it's funny that poison, like, people aren't seeing that connection, or there's something going on with poison that maybe it's the novelty of it. Maybe it's the fact that poison really has only seen significant, like, printings in, like, Scars of Mirrodin block and All Will Be One. But it's definitely very strange that people are having this reaction.
Although I have to say that I heard already in the past people complain about commander damage and say that it's something that doesn't make sense, shouldn't be in the game. I think it could be newer players most of the times. So I'm not sure, because I mostly interact with people. I mean, of course, I have my play group, but, you know, the real big discussions are always online. So I don't really know what the level of expertise of players is. But, like, this is a comment that I got in the past, that commander damage is unfair, but much less than Infect, like orders of magnitude less.
That's so interesting. Commander damage is unfair. Did you have a chance to, like, unpack that and sort of see, like, why they think it's unfair?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say it was a while ago, and recently didn't really happen to me, but I have, okay, so this will tie up also probably with the discussion around other archetypes like Mill that we may have later, but, like, I think that for some people, especially newer players, like, the way you lose a game of Magic is your life total is reduced to zero. And they really perceive it as unfair when there is another way, basically, to end the game that is not death. Like, it's some, I can't, to be honest, maybe you guys can help me understand why, because I don't really fully understand it myself. But I think it's perceived a bit of, like, you know, often, for example, in Commander, you have to take 40 damage mm-hmm. before you're dead, but, like, the commander's damage is 21, so it's less, and the Infect damage is basically 10. So, like, I think that it's seen as some way of, like, cheating and, like, killing you faster than what you're
okay.
supposed to.
So you're shortcutting, like, the quote unquote real way to win.
Exactly.
Okay. Hmm. Interesting.
Well, to, like, kind of jump onto this, like, this is, like, I played a few different versions of Burn in various formats. And I think one of the reasons that Burn gets a bad rap is because, like, I think both of you know, like, it's not like playing an aggro deck is not autopilot at all. No. Like, this is true with any kind of, like Merfolk or any deck where you're kind of low to the ground. There's a lot of decisions and you have to make the right ones. Otherwise you lose, or your creatures die, or you don't have the last three damage to throw at someone's face. And I think one of the reasons that Burn gets a bad rap is the exact same thing we're talking about here, where, like, you get them down to seven and then you have the last seven damage in your hand, like lightning bolt, you know, whatever it is, to kill a player. And people think that's cheap. You know, people are like, oh, well, that's not fair. Burn's easy mode, like, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, no, like, I had to pilot effectively knowing what you were playing. Like, I sat down and saw you were playing Grixis Control, and now I'm going to play appropriately. That's kind of the same thing with poison too. Like, you have to kill someone with poison, you have to play appropriately. You have to be able to build up the poison count. You have to get your creatures, like, in the right place. And that can feel cheap or bad or wrong for people who might not have experienced, like, the other end of that at some point in time. I think that might be also what we're talking about here.
I think that's actually an excellent point. And myself, like, I've been playing a lot of Burn in various formats, like Modern, Legacy, and even in Pioneer, because when I play 60 cards, often I, you know, for example, I love Legacy, but, you know, if I want to play in tournaments, I really don't have the kind of money you really need to put yes. into some decks. And so I like going to big Legacy tournaments, and I play Burn. And it's true that, like, especially when you play against newer players, this is an excellent point that you made, that there is a lot of hate for Burn. Yes. And yeah, as you said, like, it's totally not true that it's easy, it's autopilot to play an aggro strategy. Sometimes, for example, the difference between, you know, I shoot my lightning bolt at your creature to remove it, or I shoot it at your face, is the difference between losing and winning the game. And it can, you know, come back to bite you many turns after. So I think that that is really an excellent point. I hadn't considered that burn also gets a lot of hate from kind of newer players.
To piggyback on that a little bit, I think that that you were saying earlier, Valerio, about like the one of the issues with poison being proliferate and the fact that like you can just get poison counters on somebody and then proliferate them and they will eventually die. I think that gameplay style is actually really similar to like how a burn deck plays. But part of the reason people have a problem with that in Commander, or rather have a problem with like proliferate in Commander, is because like we don't really have burn cards that are efficient enough to scale in Commander. Like if we had like a million, you know, Flame Rift draw a card type effects, that might actually be possible to see some representation for that style of gameplay. But because like there's just nothing like that, we are getting this reaction now to the new thing that's really been like a classic deck archetype since forever.
I just wanted to say, like, I like this idea of like infect as the burn of Commander in some sense. It's true that in Commander maybe you have like kind of group slug decks, like usually how people build Torbran or now Solfheim, I guess, but it's really different from burn. I mean, maybe if there was an archetype that focused on one player at a time dealing burn damage in Commander, it would be more similar to how it's played in 1v1.
Yeah, that's the only thing similar to that is like the fireball decks that exist, or like I think one of the reasons that Exsanguinate feels really unfair to a lot of people is the same reason, where like people use the argument that, oh, so-and-so card invalidates the entire game before the card happened. But that's true of like most game-winning plays. If I drop a True Conviction and attack somebody and kill them, I just invalidated, quote-quote, you know, like everything they did before that because I killed them. But that doesn't mean True Conviction is a busted card. You know, like there's just a lot of things that do that. And Exsanguinate, Poison, Burn archetypes and other places, like they feel bad to people, and so they assess those threats improperly sometimes. I that's definitely something I've run into over the years, is like, oh, I'm going to attack you because I know you have an Exsanguinate in your deck, and it's like
I don't want to step on our own toes too much, but we are going to sort of get into like the salty cards on EDH Rec in a little bit. And
you'd be
surprised like how many of those win conditions you're suggesting end up on that salty card list.
Yeah, definitely. But yeah, so we can, do you want to go back to Poison? Do we want to talk about like specific commanders? Like what has been, I know Nick just recently played Ixel. Was that, that's the, her name, right? Mm-hmm. The new one?
Yep.
So do you want to talk about your experiences with that while you were playing?
Yeah, I would love to get into this. So, okay. There's a lot of things you should be aware of when it comes to poison decks. Poison is pretty uneven. I think that poison decks don't have as many of the high quality creatures as they would like. And so in order to fill out the deck, they tend to run a lot of like low quality cards, and they're really subject to variance. And so when you see a poison player playing out their hand, you need to recognize that like the classic poison creatures aren't as good as like the toxic creatures, which aren't as good as the infect creatures. And so a hand where the poison player starts off with Swamp Mosquito is very different from a hand where they start off with Plague Stinger, because that Plague Stinger could kill you with the right hand. The Swamp Mosquito is really not a threat, but I've seen people like aim removal at these like crappy poisonous one, toxic one, like just creatures that don't like, it's just kind of like a 4-1 flyer for two. And people are really afraid of it. And also like Ixhel as a commander, I've said this before, like when we were talking about the precons, is just not very strong. Like Toxic 2 is not very much. And it incentivizes a style of gameplay where you are almost certainly going to like kill very few people and then lose. Like concentrating three poison counters on like each for three opponents is way, way worse than getting nine poison on one person. So I've talked about this a bit when we've looked into the precons for All Will Be One, but Ixhel is not a strong commander and not a strong commander for poison specifically. Like Toxic 2 is just not a huge amount. And the gameplay that Ixhel incentivizes like is kind of likely to lead to you getting a couple poison counters on a couple players and then dying. Because getting like three poison counters each on three opponents is significantly worse than getting nine poison on one player. In terms of like actually supportive commanders, Ixhel's not very strong. Atraxa is helpful, the original Atraxa, the proliferate Atraxa, but tends to be very slow. And I think like the strongest infect commander, that the one that I would be most afraid of if I saw it at the other end of the table, is Scytherix. But it, unless somebody is specifically playing that, my fear for poison tends to be pretty low. But Valeria, I wanted to get your opinion. You've been talking with your followers a lot about poison. How are people feeling about it? Yeah. And is there anything that like any advice you would have for people going up against poison?
Yeah, so first of all, I would like to say something about Ixhel. Like we were discussing this before, but like I think it was a really, in some sense, like brave and weird choice from design, like to choose this as the commander of one of the precons, because basically there are two issues, I would say. I mean, the first one is that, as you said, it's not particularly a strong commander. And in particular, is much less powerful than the commander of the other precon, the Boros precon, which like is so good, like giving double strike to your team and allowing you cards. And so you know, if someone goes and it's a new player and says, "Oh, this commander looks cool, let me take this one," and their friend take the other one, and then they get wrecked, it doesn't like feel particularly great. And the other thing is that they stapled on a commander that's not particularly good two of the most hated things in a commander, which are poison and playing cards from your opponent's deck. So not only you have a commander that's not particularly strong, but you have to face off against a lot of hate from the other players you will meet. And if you're a new player, you will not even understand why they target you.
Yeah.
Because you don't know that Infect has such a bad reputation. Yeah, and I mean, going back to your question, some people were telling me that they were trying the... I mean, I haven't tried the Ixhel deck myself, and I haven't, played against it. But yeah, some people actually, they were telling me exactly... I mean, I have to say things in line with what we said, like that the commander feels underwhelming. Some people were telling me they switched to the other one, I think Vishkrads or something like that. But they were saying that even that one is not, I mean, it's better, but not particularly strong.
Yeah.
Some people were actually like saying that either, people in their shop showed up with an Ixhel precon and they got targeted immediately and like killed without being able to do much.
No.
Or that they maybe were able to kill one player. So it seems like a lot of people who try the deck share kind of our feeling that it's not particularly good and it gets targeted a lot.
Can I say one more thing on like the contrast between Ixhel and the Boros precon commander? One other thing that I think is kind of interesting about the two is like this sort of mirrored card draw on them. Like the fact that the Boros deck is drawing from its own deck means that you are getting more of the synergistic cards that you need in order to play the game. Like both decks require you to jump through a hoop. One of them requires you to play a lot of poison and toxic creatures. The other one requires you to play a lot of tokens. But with the Ixil deck, because you're drawing off of your opponent's decks, like unless you are literally playing the mirror match, your opponent's cards are not going to help advance your strategy. Whereas with the Boros deck, you're also drawing cards, but it's easier to do. I think that like it's a lot easier to get that deck's draw trigger, and it's just impulse draw off your own library. So you can get more tokens, so you can snowball, so you can draw more cards or get like more double striking attackers. It's just funny that like it's another, they found another way to like gimp Ixil in like, I don't understand how you're supposed to win with Ixil in the biodome.
Mm-hmm.
Have you tried the other commander, Bish Gratz, I guess?
I haven't. I'll give it a shot.
It doesn't seem particularly stronger, but at least like you bring I think it brings some tokens and then gets bigger.
You could potentially like, go wide with it a little bit more. Yeah. And it does have combo potential, which is nice.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and the sack outlets and whatnot.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like going back like to the general discussion about Infect. And like we mentioned already, the you know that Infect features in the top saltiest card on EDH rec.
Yeah.
But if you look at the cards that actually show up in that list, they are three. I mean, I would say two with a third one that is associated to Infect usually. So there's Blightsteel Colossus that has assault score of 196, Triumph of the Hordes with assault score of 159, and then Atraxa Pretos Boys with assault score of 157. It's not really an Infect card, but it's often associated to Infect. And like if you look at these cards, apart from Atraxa, which we could say, I mean, is also a popular super friend commander, and super friend is something else that a lot of people tend to not like. Mm-hmm. But like Blightsteel and Triumph of the Hordes are, I guess, two of the three cards, or four, if you include the Grafted Exoskeleton. And what's the black instant?
Tainted Strike.
Plus one, plus...
Yeah.
Tainted Strike. Yeah, exactly. I would say these are the four cards that really allow you to do what we were saying before, like to take a player out of nowhere using Infect. And they are not... they're not only featured in Infect decks. For example, you know, Blightsteel is a popular card in Satoru because you can just ninjutsu it out and one-shot someone. So, and this is a point that was brought up by other, you know, people in the Magic community. I think a lot of people, you know, have a bad feeling from that one time they were taken out by a Blightsteel out of a Satoru or something, and they remembered that as a very negative experience, and then they say, okay, I hate Infect. It's a really unfair mechanics, and I think this is another effect that you have.
That is a good point. Like, there's definitely Infect card, like a handful of Infect cards being used in non-Infect decks because they just have so much kill potential, and I think that definitely like extend that fear and that hate to like my Plague Stinger or my Cyst Bearer or just like terrible cards that happen to have the same word on them as the one shot robot or the like Infect Overrun. These cards, these like hyper powerful, like, incredibly salty Infect like win conditions. You wouldn't actually play them in an Infect deck. You're not going to play a 12-drop Blightsteel in your Ixil deck. You're not going to play a Triumph of the Hordes in a deck where everything already has Infect. So I think there is like another case where like sort of splash damage or just like associations that are causing the Infect deck to get a worse reputation than it deserves.
Can I just add something before we move on to the next archetype?
Oh, of course.
Because
yeah.
I'm guessing, you know, I'm sure like all of your listeners are really, you know, knowledgeable about Commander. But like if someone maybe amongst the listeners has faced Infect decks and they felt like they were, you know, powerless against Proliferate, or maybe we can just quickly discuss like what you can actually do to fight Infect if you feel that it's a really powerful archetype in your meta. And like what I would say, I mean, it's maybe not the most original suggestion, but the fact that Proliferate is perceived as some kind, you know, of unstoppable thing. I mean, is it really like that? Because usually there is a card, usually a permanent, it can be a Contagion Clasp, it can be an Atraxa that is doing the proliferation. So maybe, and I know, you know, this is something people say all the time, you can pack a bit more removal to deal with these cards if they really are a problem for you. And then, well, of course, but this is kind of against our argument that Infect is not such a powerful strategy. But if in your playgroup you're really facing, you're really having problems with the Infect player, there is always player removal.
And I'll say that, like, as an Infect player, I think I can fairly consistently kill like one player, maybe two players if things go well. But that actually can be a benefit to you if to have like an Infect player in your pod, if you are able to direct their aggro elsewhere. So like, please, rather than just throwing your swords to plowshares at my Plague Stinger, like make a deal with me. Just say like, hey, I have removal for that Plague Stinger. Send it somewhere else. And then of course the Infect player is going to be like, yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, they invigorate it and berserk it and somebody else dies. Well, I didn't have to spend my removal, so I'm just going to have more removal in hand when it finally gets down to 1v1, like me versus the Infect player. And this other player in the game who could potentially threaten my win has just been eliminated. So it use the Infect player in your meta as a resource, and don't be so quick to burn your removal if you can get something out of it instead.
And this actually, this made me think about something else too. You know, the last thing to add to our point that Infect is not so scary as some people perceive it.
Yeah.
Like when you run an Infect deck, most of the times, I mean, chances are you're the only one who's doing Infect damage. Mm-hmm. So other people in the group, in the pod, are not really helping you. Whereas if you run any deck that wins with combat damage, chances are that also someone else in the group is trying to win with combat damage. So, I mean, it's just going to be easier for you to take someone out because they will have taken already some damage from someone else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that feels like a huge uphill battle every time I play. In fact, just the fact that nobody is on my side, like I am 100% responsible for dealing these 30 poison counters. It can be a challenge for sure.
At this point, like, let's talk about some more other hated archetypes. So I think something to note here is that they are, in general, alternate win conditions. And one of the biggest, most often overly prepped for alternate win conditions, I would say, is mill. So do we want to get into some mill as a strategy, mill cards, and why do you think people overestimate the capability of mill decks?
Well, I think the first thing that we should mention that I think everyone is aware of is that in Commander, okay, so let's say you are in Modern, and actually this is not a joke, because right now mill is a pretty strong deck in Modern, because so many decks run, you know, very, very low curves. And there is, you know, there are cards like Tasha's Hideous Laughter that basically allow you to mill half of a Modern player's decks, which are pretty good. And the mill has been putting up some nice results in Modern. But there, you have to mill let's say, a bit less than 60 cards to win. In Commander, you have to mill something closer to 300 cards to win a game, which is like you can really see. And the cards, of course, they are balanced for Modern, because, you know, if you print like a, for 60 card formats, because if you print a one mana instant mill 20 cards, you will immediately make a mill overpowered in 60 card formats. And so those cards are balanced for that. And so you can see how they cannot really, you know, you will have a hard time trying to mill someone fairly in Commander.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, they can do a little bit with just like each opponent, but still it's for sure an uphill battle with library sizes the way they are. So I definitely agree with you that like mill is not a strong strategy in Commander just because of the constraints of the format. So, but what sort of like emotional reaction have you seen from players in response to these mill decks?
Yeah, and I think this is really one of the most interesting things about mill for me. And I've seen this, you know, playing with people in real life, but also you see it on streams. And like, there is this kind of strong reaction and a strong, I think, psychological reaction when you see your cards milled. And people really say that they hate to lose access to their cards, like to see them. I think there is something, you know, about seeing the card exiled or in your graveyard and thinking, you know, oh, I could have used this card to do this and that, and I cannot. And you have people telling you, you know, oh, there is a reason why I put cards in my deck and I hate when I lose access to them. And I kind of understand, but at the same time, if you really think about it, in the typical Commander game, what percentage of your deck will you see? And, you know, I was running some numbers and I just, you know, assume that a game goes on for 8 turns and you draw an average of 2 cards per turn. And this will lead you to see around 23, let's say 25 cards. So basically, you know, during the average game, you will see 1/4 of your deck. You know, there are plenty of cards that you will not see in the average game. So what really is the difference if you just don't see them because you don't draw into them, or if they get milled? Like, in both situations, you don't get to play them. So for me, like, it really doesn't make a big difference, but for some people, it definitely does.
Yeah, and I think a lot of decks, well, for me, I have come to like appreciate mill and not mind getting milled so much. But part of that for me has just been like, I've played a lot of decks with graveyard recursion where getting milled is actually a benefit for me. And I think that a lot of players might not realize that when they see the mill deck, like they might not either run much recursion in their deck or recognize like how good it is for them. And they also aren't really weighing the fact that like the mill player, by giving out free cards that can be sort of like putting cards into a zone that some players can easily recur, that's just another handicap on mill as a strategy. Like, you are often giving away free cards in the process of like pursuing this mill strategy. And it's something that, and similar to Infect, nobody else generally is really helping the mill player get to where they need to be. Like, it's not something that happens in the majority of Commander games. So mill players, they've got a really, really hard road to walk because it's difficult to pull off and they're giving away cards and nobody else is helping them. So it's,
yeah, absolutely.
For sure a challenge.
As you may guess, like, I love Golgari as a color combination, and like basically every time I'm playing a Golgari deck, if you're milling me, I'm just happy.
Yeah,
because I get to reanimate stuff and you know, turn on whatever synergy I have with the graveyard. Mm-hmm. For example, it just happened to me today. Actually, I was playing with some friends, and one of them was on Anowon, and they milled a guy, and they milled a Sevin's reclamation. So the guy was able, you know, to bring stuff back from their graveyard. Ouch. So it's like, you know, yeah, as you said, like with the amount of recursion that we have in modern commander decks, and the amount of recursion that I think everyone should be playing, chances are that actually you're basically drawing people cards. And yeah, sure, like you can have some Leyline of the Void or something to exile, but actually this is not so common in my experience. And usually, like, most of the most played mill cards in mill decks, they just send cards to the graveyard.
Mm-hmm. No, I think so. You have some other... Do you want to get into some numbers? Because you actually did a good job compiling, like, actual data to maybe assuage, like, the fears of people who are like, you know, no, I get milled and, like, bad things happen. Yeah. And I actually think that it's worth, like, stating, like, how little a non-combo mill deck is going to do to you, even if you don't have recursion, you know? Like, let's say, like...
Yeah, for example... Mm-hmm. Yeah, sorry.
There, you're good.
No, for example, a complaint that you hear pretty often is that maybe there is some player that, I don't know, they haven't been hitting their land drops, and then someone mills them, and they see, like, three lands going to the graveyard, and they're like, oh no, I really needed those lands, right? I mean, I'm already mana screwed, and now my lands are in the graveyard. How can I come back? But actually, if you just, you know, yeah, run some numbers, and let's say you run 36 lands in your 99, and someone mills you for 10, well, assuming that you have more or less, you shuffled your deck well, and you have a more or less homogeneous distribution of lands in your deck, you will have roughly 3 to 4 lands, like 3.6 on average lands, that will be milled along with those 10 cards. So the initial probability to draw a land was 36 over 99, which is more or less 36%. And the new probability, well, you have to subtract those 3 or 4 lands that have been milled from the initial 36 and divide by 89. So that is like the number of cards you had in your deck minus the cards that got milled. And if you just do this, you will see that the probability remains 36%. So, like, just assuming that you have an homogeneous distribution of lands in your deck or really of any other card, let's say that they're milling, I don't know, your card draw. But if it's homogeneously distributed in your deck, it's not really going to affect your next draws. I think the only exception, and this is like maybe the only case in which you should be a bit afraid of milling, is if you have, like, if you literally can only win with a single combo. Mm-hmm. And let's say, I mean, part of this combo gets exiled because someone mills you by exiling your cards. In that case, maybe, I don't know, you want to run an Ulamog or something in your deck to prevent this. But I'm not even sure, right? Because, I mean, yeah, I don't know. Even if I had a deck in which I could literally only win with a single card combo, I mean, probably I would have, you know, a bunch of counterspell and tutors to get the combo and protect it. So chances are I would just, if I someone was trying to mill half of my deck, I would just counter their spell if I was really scared about losing my combo.
Yeah.
Yeah, really quick. I just want to dig into something really quickly. So kind of on the topic of, like, people being afraid to mill, like, what if I mill my good card or whatever? I think a great example of this is, or like the reluctance people have to run these types of effects or to mill themselves as a cost, is Demonic Bargain from Crimson Vow.
Oh yeah.
So Demonic Bargain is a 2 and a black for a sorcery. Exile the top 13 cards of your library, then search your library for a card, put that card into your hand, then shuffle. So I think this is actually, like, one of the more efficient tutors out there. There aren't a lot of 3 mana or less unconditional tutors. And so I think it's quite good. And if your deck isn't, like, doesn't have a single linchpin when it comes to winning the game, then I think this is just, like, a fairly efficient tutor. but it's in only 1363 decks on EDH Rec, so 0% approximately of the million decks on there, or like maybe 1%.
Yeah,
and
actually, no, and I was saying even the money consultation, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, like you can use it as a combo with Tassa's Oracle, but like you can also use it as a tutor, and I've seen people in CDH using it as such. Like if you really need an answer, you can actually cast the money consultation as a tutor, and chances are it will work perfectly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And just like as a point of comparison, Grim Tutor is one black for a sorcery. Search your library for a card, put that card in your hand, then shuffle, and you lose three life. So I think it's the effect of the two cards are pretty comparable. Like there's a slight cost to running either one, but Grim Tutor is in 78,000 decks on EDH Rec compared again to the 1,000 for Demonic Bargain. So like I think that right there is a good example of like the psychological difference between like milling your cards versus paying life, because that's really the only fundamental difference between the cards.
You make me want to try out Demonic Bargain in some ways.
I was very high on it during Crimson Vow, and then I was extremely surprised that like everybody appeared to be sleeping on it.
But have you actually tried it in some decks?
I don't run a lot of unconditional tutors, I have not. But
yeah, I'm kind of the same. Like usually, if I run tutors, I try to run stuff that is like for a specific card type.
Yeah, same.
Because otherwise, I don't know. I think it's a bit too powerful for my usual meta.
I generally only run unconditional tutors if like my deck is really built around something that's not in the command zone and I need a critical mass of tutors to find it or a similar effect every game.
So I want to say like one thing that's kind of funny when we're talking about mill. I feel like I heard more complaints that mill was an unusable strategy back like 10 years ago, because people had a lot easier access to like the original, like Eldrazi Titans and Ulamog, the Kozilek, you know, that when they hit your graveyard, they shuffle everything back in. And I feel like because of the speed of the format back then, especially Kozilek, like I would see just a random Kozilek much more often in somebody's deck than I do now. And part of that is price tag. Part of that was the set was still in print and all that stuff. But slowly as the ability to pick up these cards waned, that's when I saw these complaints and these discussions around mill pick up again. So it's funny that like now that like these universe, like the speed of the format has sped up, which kind of invalidates mill as an archetype, because you, unless you're just comboing, like milling 10 cards a few times isn't going to cut the mustard, you know, that's not going to get you there. But also these like universal mill deterrents aren't there either. So really, I think what I would recommend is I never get milled anymore. And it's because everyone knows that I run Ramunap Excavator and like Recursion and Genesis and all these things in my deck. So just, I would say if you're really scared of mill, just become the player that's known for Recursion in your playgroup, and you'll never get milled ever again. No one will ever trust you with the power of a large graveyard ever again.
What you say about the Eldrazi Titans, it's interesting because just today I was discussing with someone on Twitter, because they posted something about the fact that they have a Ulamog or something that they just slot in their deck game two when they are facing a mill opponent, which is kind of, I mean, I guess like if your playgroup allows you to do that, go for it. But like, it feels really, I mean, if I was the mill player, I would feel, you know, I cannot win anymore. So I would probably swap deck because, yeah, you just, you know, sideboard against me and hard counter my strategy. So what am I supposed to do? And like, yeah, and personally, even if, you know, these cards were like $2, sorry, I don't think I would personally. Yeah, I mean, I love recursion, as I said, as Zach, but like I wouldn't feel the need to really run them.
Yeah,
because in my experience, like, yeah, it's so rare that I get milled out in a game of Commander.
Yeah, the only times it really ever happens to me are when it's a dedicated combo. So, like, I think you have one written down, but like we had a friend with like a Phoenix God of Deception deck. And it would just like play an Eater of the Dead and kill you that way, you know, like basically like a 1.5 card combo with your commander. Like you play your commander and play this one card and you're good. And that's really the only times it's ever been a problem played against willingly. So this person was not being rude, but five color Kenrith combo CEDH deck that killed the whole table by mailing us out on turn 3. So like, those are really the only instances that I've ever been milled out like to death, you know, like that doesn't really happen, which I think kind of just reiterates the point and connects this to the poison strategy where like, I think it's when people die to things that they're not used to that triggers some response in their brain that like they have to pay attention to this thing now. And so they worry about it more than they should. But I really do think that it's not a big deal. like really, like I've been playing Magic for like a very long time now, like much longer than a decade at this point in my life. And has it been too? I'm not going to think about that. I'm not going to think about how long I've been playing. And the amount of games of any format that I've been milled to death are so small, you know, compared to like the amount of games I played in my life. So it really is like just looking at numbers, not something anyone should really be putting this much of their like brain power into avoiding. It's really okay. And if you are someone listening to this and there's a male player in your group and it really makes you upset, like there's hope, you know, you can get around it. It'll be okay.
I wanted to say about the combo thing and, you know, another very, I don't know if it's prevalent, I don't know if it's, but like famous one is Bruvac, which you can play as your commander, mm-hmm. and then you can play Maddening Cacophony and mill everyone, basically. But like, if you get killed by a combo, does it really matter if it was mill or something else? Like,
yeah,
you can get taken out by so many two card combos that like, I mean, mill is just one of them. The result is the same. You just die.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I saw you had a note about that. And you also had another thing that I thought was interesting about just the top saltiest cards in regards to mill. So do you want to share what you found about this, which I thought was pretty hilarious, honestly?
Oh, yeah. You mean the fact I was checking the top 10 saltiest card with the Shrek for this episode. And I noticed that there are exactly 0 mill cards. So,
yeah
this is quite interesting because I really, you know, I really don't know. There are one thing that you can notice if you look at the list is that there are a bunch of cards that you really don't see very often, like Stasis and Armageddon and these kind of things that people complain about, but no one actually plays in my experience. Mm-hmm. And mill, like, yeah, I mean, it's not the most played strategy, but there are always a couple of mill players. But if you actually look at the top saltiest cards, there are no mill cards there.
Yeah, like in 100 cards, out of the 100 saltiest cards in Magic, according to EDH Rec users, none of them are mill cards. Like, so I think that's just another point against mill as like something to complain about or something to worry about or like a threat to assess.
Yeah, although when I say, for example, that it's possible that it's a strategy that once again is hated, especially by newer players that maybe are not so much aware of EDH rec and this kind of things. So yeah, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. And
that is a good point. Factor. Like, the people who are, you know, contributing to the salt polls that EDH Rec conducts are like extremely enfranchised players for the most part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. There's probably a disconnect there. We just have to get more new players into playing like Golgari and Sultai and stuff like that. You know, we just got to get more of them into the black and green graveyard lists, or red. You know, there's a bunch of stuff going on there. You got your Goblin Welders and whatnot. So we just got to get them started
always,
early.
Always in favor of that. And actually, I can say to everyone that it's one of the most fun strategies, at least for me. You basically have another hand of cards that's usually much bigger than your regular hand, and you get to play with all those cards, and it's super fun. You shouldn't be afraid really to, you know, drop them in the bin, because then you get to reanimate them and do a bunch of cool stuff with them. It's really fun.
Yep, absolutely. Love me a graveyard. Love discarding my hand. Love milling myself. So, yeah, is there any other last thoughts anybody has, or do we want to kind of... I'm probably forgetting something. Is there something I'm not hitting on?
I don't know if you can you find it interesting, but I wanted to briefly mention this this poll.
Oh yeah, yeah.
That I posted on Twitter, and for me, like, it really showcases like how much for some how strong some people how strongly they hate, you know, getting milled, and in particular when your cards get exiled. So I asked the following question. Imagine they printed the following card, 4B, so 4 and a black mana, instant, exile target creature. You can cast this spell without paying its mana cost by exiling 10 cards from the top of your library. And I asked, without any specific exile synergy, would you play it in your EDH deck? And I got something close to 1,500 votes. And 68% of players replied yes. 9% replied that it depends. But 23%, so like 1/4 of the player, replied that they wouldn't run it. And admittedly, some players say they wouldn't run it because it was too strong. But some other players were just like, no, I wouldn't run it because the drawback is too big. This is a, you know, 10, this is a 10 for one or whatever. So it's bad. It's a bad card. So what do you guys think of this hypothetical card?
I think it's busted.
Yeah.
I mean, it reminds me a lot of like Snuff Out, or like Deadly Rollick or whatever.
Deadly Rollick. Yeah. I think, you know, it's even, I would say personally that it's even stronger
than
Deadly Rollick, because it doesn't really, it doesn't need your commander to be on the field.
Yeah.
And actually, the tweet like got kind of, you know, a big reach, and I got some pro players like from Legacy and Modern commenting like, oh, can I have this in like Legacy? I would jam like 4 copies in every single deck I have. Mm-hmm. And there, like, you're milling like 1/6 of your deck.
Yeah.
Like, you're exiling 1/6 of your deck.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, yeah, there's this thing that, like, some people really perceive, like, getting milled for, you know, 10 by one card as a 10 for one. But it's not like that, because the way card advantage works and the math of card advantage works is that when they remove something from the field or from your hand, which is a resource that you have access to, that's, you know, that's an exchange. But if they remove something, like, say, from your graveyard or from your deck, which you don't have immediate access to, that's not, you know, a 10 for one or whatever. Otherwise, you know, Glimpse the Unthinkable would be a straight up 10 for one for 2 mana, which is ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah. No, definitely the concept of like card advantage is something that, or like what specifically like a 2-for-1 is, you know, like in that kind of terms, is hard for some people to pick up at first. Cause obviously, like, to someone who's been playing a long time, this is not a 10 for one. But if you are just thinking about card advantages, like, oh, how many cards have I interacted with? Like, then maybe it gets a little bit confusing there. But yeah, this it's definitely a busted spell. I think it would be just like an all-timer if this card ever was actually printed. You know, like,
yeah, I mean, I wouldn't run it, but the reason was would be that it would cost like $200.
So I couldn't afford it. Yeah, but too much money. Well, yeah, so I think this has been good. We covered, like, I think two of the biggest culprits of the misappropriation, like the bad threat assessment. But there's also like some other archetypes basically that get a lot of hate. And I think it's probably worth discussing them. Do you want to get into some other, these aren't necessarily win conditions like the other two were. These are more like play styles, I guess we could call them. What's the first one we'd want to talk about?
We can talk about counter heavy decks. So it's, a lot of Magic designers have talked about the fact that counter spells cause more salt than removal, even though a lot of times it's the exact same effect. And it's to the extent where they're not like every color has access to removal of some kind, but Wizards has made the conscious decision to limit counter spells just to blue because they are so disliked, and they want players to know if they're not playing against a blue deck, they don't have to worry about like that particular thing happening to them. So let's talk a little bit about counter heavy decks. Why, maybe we can float some theories on like why counter spells are so hated, and talk about like what the right amount of hate is for these types of decks.
Yeah, I think what you said is really interesting, and it's possible that you listen to the same podcast that I listen to, because I was listening, you know, there Mark Crosswater has been interviewing, as you guys did some time ago, the members of the Council of Colors.
Oh, yeah.
And he recently interviewed Chris Mooney, which is the white member of the Council of Colors.
That was the episode I listened to.
And they were... Exactly. Yeah, because super interesting thing for me is that white is actually secondary in counter spells, and actually you have some of them. You know, you have Manathite. You have was it Lapse of Certainty?
Yes, that's right.
You have Rebuff the Wicked and these kind of things. But like we rarely see them, and exactly what they were saying is what you said before: is that especially with newer players, they really, feel bad about counter spells. And so if they know that they have to expect them only from a blue deck, it will be a bit better for them than just, you know, having to expect them also from a white deck. Because at that point, if they see a white deck, they will be on edge. And in this case, you know, they will only be on edge if they are against a blue deck, which is, I mean, is from... is where the meme of like everyone hates blue and Basic Island is the most powerful card in Magic. It originates from there, from counter spells.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So why do y'all think that counter spells feel so much worse? And I have a theory, but I want to hear your takes on this.
I have one thing that I've been thinking of just because I started playing Arena again pretty consistently is like, I think the timing of counter spells feels worse. Like a kill spell, it's like, oh, I top decked a kill spell and I killed your thing. Like, oops. And a counter spell is like, well, do they have it? Okay, they have it. And then you try again. You're like, all right, do they have another one? Okay, they had another one. And like that, I think, play pattern of like, they have to have it at the particular time. And then they did have it at the particular time, I think can be a little bit upsetting, on top of other things that I think Valeria might also be hitting on. That's what I was thinking about.
I'm just thinking, definitely agree. I'm just thinking about it now. And this is not something I really thought about, but could it be because you feel a bit kind of more outplayed? Yeah, it's very close to what you said, but like you feel kind of outplayed, outsmarted, because like they were waiting for it and like you fell into the trap. Whereas if it's a kill spell, yeah, maybe, you know, maybe they drew that later, as you said, or like it could have been used against whatever. But like for the counter spell, they were really, sometimes maybe you have the feeling they were waiting for it, for me to cast this, and I fell into the trap like some fool, you know?
That is exactly what I was thinking. It feels like you got yeah, you got outsmarted. Like, they intentionally left up some mana rather than spending it on their turn because they knew you were going to do something. They prepared for you, and you had no choice but to just, like, walk into it like a chump. whereas, like, if they, yeah, it doesn't matter when they draw the removal or when they cast the removal, but, like, they don't have to think about it. They don't have to prepare for it.
Yeah, I think this is a great way of looking at it. And actually, something that I think you learn more playing 1v1, like 60-card formats, you really, I play a lot of aggro decks, and you really learn, a couple things. And the first one is basically to pay attention to what lands they have untapped, which in Commander maybe doesn't come up as often because, you know, chances are if you're playing against some more control-y deck, they will have, you know, usually a lot of mana open or there are a bunch of free spells, so it's less important. But like in a format like, let's say, Pioneer, in which you don't even have the free spells, it's super important to really pay attention to what lands they have untapped and stuff. And the other thing that's important, that is something that I think is super relevant with dealing with the counter heavy deck, is that sometimes you just have to make them have it. Mm-hmm. Because like, as some people say, like the most powerful counter spell is the one that you never cast. Because if you just with the fear of, you know, of your counter spells, you lead your opponent to not play anything, you will just win, because your game plan as a control deck is like to slow down your opponent during the early game to get to your big win condition. So if you have troubles facing against counter heavy deck, I would say that sometimes you just have to make them have it. Like, just cast your spell, and maybe you can also use a bait, so something that's like of secondary importance for you, and make them counter it, and then, you know, play your relevant spell. And in Commander, you can even make deals. So you can, and this comes up with another one of the most saltiest card, which is the new Jinji Taxius.
Oh, yeah.
Like, the one that counters the first, I think, like, artifacts, instant or sorcery spell, everyone casting a turn. Sometimes you see players completely paralyzed because they say, whatever I play, it will be countered. But you can, you know, either cast something, get it count, like some mana rock, get it counter, and then cast your important spell. Or you can make deals with other players to trigger the ability and then cast, the removal that you need to take the Jinji Taxius out.
Yeah, and there's definitely a skill of knowing how to bait counter spells. Like, knowing what kind, like, and this isn't relevant against Jinji Taxius, but against just, like, you know, a grip full of counter spells. If they only have enough mana open to cast one counter spell, you need to know, like, what kind of card is going to be scary enough that you can get them to cast their counter spell so that you can cast, like, the thing that will actually break their back. That's definitely a skill that's worth developing if you're playing against a lot of these types of decks.
Yeah, it is also funny because, like, countering spells, like, was basically, like, on the inception of the game was, like, the safeguard, like, escape valve. Of like, okay, well, if we printed something that was too much, like, these will take care of it. And pretty much from the get-go has always been like you were saying, like, Island is overpowered, like, because the escape valve just was kind of a catch-all for everything. It's always been that way. So it's funny that a lot of the most powerful counter spells are still just the original ones, you know? Like... counter spell,
Force of Will.
Yeah, mana drain, all from those first like 5-ish years of the game, you know, like that. Lately we've gotten some crazy ones, you know, the last few years we got, like you said, Jinji Taxius, and
An Offer You Can't Refuse.
We've gotten some, but those ones are particular.
Fierce Guardianship.
Yeah,
Fierce Guardianship, yeah, wild. But it seems like they figured out like the spaces for them, so like a Force of Negation, you know, like, they're like, okay, we can print this card and it won't break these formats. So it looks like they have a better handle on how to make powerful counter spells that are like fun to play around. And it is kind of a fun question, like as someone who plays not just Commander, but like many formats, like that, it's like, okay, do they have the Force of Negation right now? Like, do they not? Like, do I try to bait the Force of Negation? And what if they don't have it? Then I'm behind on board. You know, like trying to figure that out is something that's fun. So I think that is something I would recommend to people who really hate counter heavy decks, is I would either just run Pyroblast or just try to go with the thought experiment of like, okay, well, if they do have a counter spell right now, how do I get around it? Or maybe I can make a deal with them. Like, hey, I want to do this thing. Can you not counter it so that I can like punish player Y instead or something like that? Like that there's people are in charge of their own actions. It's not like the counterspell player is going to want to counterspell every single like thing that happens in a game. And I feel like only the most insane Commander deck ever would be able to do that, because they're just one for one exchanges, you know, like just not possible. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, and this is something that I definitely wanted to mention, that like, if you're like in Modern or like in any 1v1 format, it's really possible to be a control deck. And, you know, the really draw go control deck that counters all of your important spells and then casts a Teferi and wrecks you. But like in Commander, you're against three players. And if you really think about it, every time you cast a counter spell, you're losing a card. And the other player whose spell is countered is also losing a card. So you're basically virtually drawing one card each to the two other players. If you think about the math of the exchange, the other two players that were not involved just went up one card each. Mm-hmm. So this is really really shows you how one for ones are really bad in Commander. And so you should treat them as such. Like, you know, how we see, for example, more and more this removal spell that there is a really good one that's the instant that forces each opponent to sacrifice a creature with the highest mana cost.
Oh, Soul Shatter?
Soul Shatter, exactly. Mm. Those are really good in Commander because they are not one for ones, because they are three for ones. But like most counter spells are just one for ones. And so your opponent is not going to want to just counter all that, is not going to be able and is not going to want to counter all that you play. It will keep the counter spell for the very important spells.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's also another thing too, is when you're playing against a counter deck, like how do they win? Like if you keep track of how that deck is going to win the game, then you can better determine when they're going to try to do that thing. Like a lot of these control decks don't have a lot of win conditions. Sometimes it's control into combo. Sometimes they just try to play like an evasive 6/6 and get you that way really slowly. Like maybe it is poison, you know, it could be a few different things. But if you keep track of how like the counter heavy deck wins, then you can play around that and you can stop them from doing that. It's not like, oh no, you're just countering all my spells and I'm having a bad time. It's like, oh well, I can mess with their stuff too. Like there's three other players here. Like as long as we understand like what the game plan is, you can also formulate your own plan around that. And it's not like just a lost cause to play against these decks sometimes. It can be frustrating, you know, like Killspell the deck can be frustrating in the same way that Counterspell the deck can be frustrating, but this seems like one of the strategies where people are more upset at the play patterns than like the fact that they lose to it all the time. You know, because I don't think I've lost to a counter like a Drago deck in a very long time.
Yeah definitely, you don't see them.
If you miss that experience, I recommend you play Historic Brawl in Arena.
Yeah exactly.
What are some examples of Drogo commanders on Historic Brawl? I don't play it a lot.
Oh, so. I mean, so Brawl is legal.
Okay. And in that's the thing. Like in 1v1, those counter spells get much better.
Oh yeah, much better.
Than in... No, please go on. Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say, like, there are a lot, like, it specifically in, like, historic Brawl, like you're saying, like, because in 1v1, like, the counter spells are better. Like, pretty much any, what's his name, the ninja, Planeswalker.
Kaito,
yeah. Kaito usually has a lot of counter spells, like Brawl. Like, it's just something that, like, you see much, much, much more often in that kind of format. So definitely not necessarily, I don't know. It's, there are people where, if I'm playing a control deck on historic Brawl, they just scoop pretty much immediately. Mm-hmm. I think the Rusko Clockmaker decks have really been proving that point too, you know?
Ooh, yeah. I've seen some videos of that one I don't think the problem there is the control aspect. It's just that that card is completely busted.
Oh, yeah. So
you
stupid,
can just do
yeah.
all your 1-for-1 exchanges and trust your midnight clocks to refill your hand. And yeah.
Yeah, it just doesn't matter. Disgusting. Anyway, back to Commander. You don't have to deal with that in Commander.
I thought it might be just, fun also to take a look at which counter spells cards appear on the top 10 saltiest card. And actually, in this case, we have a lot of them. So we have Fierce Guardianship at 2.21 salt points. Then we have Gingitaxias Progress Tyrant at 186. Force of Will, 179. Mana Drain, 171. And Force of Negation, 169. Do you notice some pattern in these counter spells?
I think this is something we were planning on touching on later. But yeah, there's definitely, I think a dollar value, you take the average of these, it's going to be pretty high.
Yeah. I also think the free aspect of these, like Mana Drain gets you the mana refunded plus, you know, like Force of Negation, you have zero lands untapped, Force of Will, Fierce Guardianship. And then once you drop a Gingitaxias, it doesn't matter. You're like, all right, well, do you have two kill spells? Like, no? All right.
Yeah, the Gingitaxias for me is, kind of the outsider in this list, but like, I understand it because I think it's an example of like counter-centric card that works in Commander.
Yeah.
Because it's going to be able to counter one spell per turn, basically, without you doing anything. You just need to protect him. And so it's actually interesting because it's a very recent card and it's already so high on the salt list. So it's likely that it will be even higher in the future.
Oh yeah. I mean, I've gotten to play with this. I have a Azorius reanimator, like Legends reanimator list. And it's amazing how many like 6 mana plus legendary creatures in white and blue are like very salty. And this guy has been absolutely insane. Like the new Gingitaxias, just pretty much most people at the table start complaining immediately upon this guy hitting the board.
And I'm curious to hear what you noticed when, because for example, I was playing the new Mishra precon in a pod, and a guy was on Satoru. So they had Gingitaxias on the field, and basically it was pretty late in the game. And I have to say the Mishra Prigon is really incredible out of the box. It's really strong.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I had a lot of mana and basically a grip full of cards. And basically what I would do was just, as I said before, just cast a mana rock, trigger the Gingitaxias, and then cast my big spell. So, I'm curious to hear what your opponent, what is the approach of your opponents usually to resolve the Gingitaxias?
Oh yeah. So usually if I do, cause usually I'm not casting Gingitaxias. It's usually like late for dinner or something that reanimates it. And the play pattern tends to be, they see Gingitaxias go to the graveyard and someone goes, do you have graveyard hate? And if they don't, I go, some reanimate spell in white. And then they go, okay, Well, now there's an arch enemy. So now all three of us are going to try to figure out how to blow up Jingataxius. And it kind of becomes this mini game where all three of them are trying to figure out how to do it. And if I can get ahead on board while they're trying to do that, then I usually end up winning. But if not, sometimes it's like, I have a kill spell and something else, so I'll take care of it, guys. Like, don't worry about it. And then it gets to that person's turn and like cast Cultivate and then cast Beast Within or, you know, something like that. So it's usually the table kind of like ends up trying to help each other to take care of the problem. And I don't think I played a single game with Jingataxius out at this point where that hasn't happened.
So you see them like collaborate. Like, for example, let's say I cast my Cultivate during my turn and you cast your Doomblade and we get rid of the Jingataxius.
No, because it can't. It's per player. So it basically comes down to like, I'm pretty sure it's per player, right?
I thought it triggered only once. Wait, let me check. This ability triggers only once each turn. So.
Oh, you're right. Okay, yeah, they can collaborate. Yeah. That hasn't been my experience. So usually it's like, it probably has been that there is a
maybe they haven't figured spells. That out.
Usually that's what happens. Someone goes, oh well, I have two spells, I can take care of it, or like I have a spell in a wrath or something. So which is actually
pretty bad, because like when I said that I was, you know, triggering the Jingataxius, it was because in that game it was basically down to me against the Satoru player. But like I would think twice about, you know, 2-for-1-ing myself, basically, to get rid of Jingataxius, because, as we said before, this way you're giving a huge advantage to the other player. So I think that my approach would be to try to make, as I was saying, a deal. Like, you know, you cast your Cultivate in your turn, gets countered, and I cast my Doomblade on the Jingataxius.
Yeah. Yeah, then I think that that's probably most people's experience. That's usually what ends up happening with a lot of the Praetors. The original Vorinclex, usually the same thing happens. People go, oh, well, I'll take the fall, kill the Vorinclex, and not have my lands on tap. So just as long as you don't kill me, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
So all this said, we've talked about some counter spells. Are there any other feel bads that we want to mention before we start closing out the episode?
There is one that I really want to mention, because for me it was wild. Like I wouldn't understand, but it seems like Farewell is a spell that is perceived that's super salt inducing from many players.
Oh yeah.
And I wanted to hear what you guys think about it, and what is your experience with this card.
That's funny. Do you want to start, Nick?
Well, I can say I haven't played against it a ton in Paper Magic. I have played against it a lot on Arena. And I think part of it is it just gets around a lot of ways that people will typically play around Wraths. So, for example, like...
Yeah, like your Heroic Intervention and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. So, like, you can't give your stuff indestructible. You can't plan to like recur your stuff from the graveyard. You can't diversify your card types. Just like the common ways that people usually deal with the Wrath that they expect don't work. The only thing that really works is like phasing your stuff out. And there's not a ton of ways to do that. So I think that is probably it. It's just like much better at doing the thing that white has been doing for a million years.
Yeah. I think that it's funny because I haven't actually noticed that many people being salty. Like usually when someone casts a Farewell in the games, and I've actually seen a few Farewells in person at this point, like probably at least like a dozen or so at this point. And it's usually to like the applause of like two other people at the table. Like, two people are like, yay, like we aren't losing to so-and-so anymore. Because it is wild how thoroughly it wipes everything. Like, oh, the artifact deck that's playing out of the graveyard is now just screwed. You know, oh, the creature heavy deck that was killing us all is dead. You know, like it's pretty wild, but I haven't seen too much salt in person with that card. There are other cards that I've seen just make people very, very salty the last few months, I guess. But I think you also had them listed out, so we can get into some of those.
Let me say one more thing about Farewell. Mm-hmm. One thing is that, like, if you know the Farewell's coming, it's asymmetrical. So you're going to, whoever's casting it is going to be able to get hit less hard than everyone else. But it also just like looks a lot like an Ugin activation, like an Ugin 1.0 activation.
Yeah, minus X.
Yeah. Like, how do you think that like Ugin had a lot of salt associated with it?
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely think so.
I mean, wasn't it, I think Ugin was banned on Historic.
It is banned in Historic
because
Brawl.
Because players felt that it would invalidate the whole, you know, previous game actions. And so, yeah, I think it's an excellent connection. Like, I think that with Farewell, I mean, the complaint I heard is exactly this, that it completely invalidates everything that went on in the game up to that point, mm-hmm. which, I mean, up to some level, I can kind of understand because it's definitely, like, for me, it's like top five strongest board wipes in Commander.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And so it's definitely like an extremely powerful card. And when you're facing an extremely powerful card, that can often be a strong response. But yeah, I think this is the point of view of many players, that it invalidates what went on before.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. But I think from there, we can move on to some other feel bads. One, if you look over the like 100 saltiest cards, I mean, you're going to see a lot of like mass land destruction. But another thing that shows up a lot is extra turn effects. I think this one has a pretty straightforward explanation, but I just want to hear your takes on why people find extra turns to be so salty.
Yeah, I think it's time equity. So it's just like you're taking a lot of game time for yourself and then other players. I mean, already in a game of Commander, you have to wait quite a bit to take your turn. But if someone else is taking all the turns, you have to wait a lot. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't feel good. And actually, I had this experience, like I built this Emoti deck with a Keruga Companion. And I just found out, you know, that I'm playing like three extra turn spells or something like that. But I don't know, they're just very, I mean, personally, I think they're fun to resolve. And also, of course, there is a synergy with the Commander that just, you know, cascades out of the extra turn spell. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that I feel bad when I play the deck because I'm, especially at the beginning, I was taking these very, you know, long turns in which I cascaded and took a lot of game actions, then extra turn. And so my approach has been, well, first to limit myself in the number of extra turn spells I play, and second, just to add some more win cons and learn to play faster. Mm-hmm. Because mm-hmm. the worst thing when someone is playing a lot of extra turn spells, if they're taking them slowly. That's really the worst.
Actually, to piggyback off of that, I think that's actually like, I don't think that extra turn spells are necessarily like very bad or the worst things. I do think that playing slowly is much, much worse for most players. You know, there's it's much more likely that, let's say, that you have a dirtily Lord Windgrace player or something who their turn is going to take 20 minutes, and that's going to cause more, if not the same amount of salt, you know, as, let's say, like, just an extra turn spell might, you know?
I just wanted to say that. Oh,
go ahead. No, you go ahead.
No, I just wanted to say, an archetype that I think, I mean, there are not many archetypes I really dislike, but one that I that I don't tend to like playing against is blink decks. Because, like, for example, let's say Brago, this kind of decks, they're like, okay, now I blink all my stuff and I have 10 triggers. Let's resolve these triggers. And then I'm going to do it again in your turn. And I think it kind of goes back to the same thing, right?
Mm-hmm. I'm kind of tempted to, like, maybe have us do an episode on, like, just tech decks that take a long time to play. Like, if you want to feel like you played the most Magic of everyone else, then these are the decks to play. Because I've definitely, like, a couple archetypes that stand out to me as ones that require a lot of game time are, like, Super Friends decks, because you're activating so many different planeswalkers over the course of your turn. And they also, like, tend to run extra turn effects. And also, like, one thing I noticed when I built my Azuri 3.0 Proliferate deck is how much time I was consuming just by, like, I proliferate. Okay, that means I have to tick up these dice on these five different permanents. And if I'm proliferating multiple times in a turn, it's just, like, adding a lot of time to the game that, like, without really accomplishing anything, you know, like, just like the physical constraints of I have to move these dice up, I have to track all of this, results in a lopsided gameplay.
I absolutely understand, because just yesterday I decided to dismantle my Hamza deck, you know, the Selesnya elephant that discounts your creature spell depending on how many counters you have on your creatures, like, exactly for this reason. Because, like, sometimes when I play it, I feel like an accountant. Like, I spend more time ticking up dice, and especially if you have something like a Cathar Crusade on the field, it gets really tiring. And so, yeah, I mean, this kind of plus one counters, proliferate, super friend decks, they also have this negative side. Mm-hmm.
I think we can maybe move on to another type of feel bad, which I think shows up a little bit in the salty cards, but this is steel effects. And I think we should delineate between steel effects, like, you know, control magic type of thing, versus the Gonti sort of, like, play my opponent's cards kind of steel effect.
Yeah.
Because I think both of them have, like, a negative psychological response, but I think, like, the degree is different. And I think there are some people who get annoyed by one, but not by the other. So let's start with just, like, I am stealing your creature kind of thing. What have been, like, the reactions you've seen to that? Do you think it's the hate is justified? How do you feel?
So for me, for example, I have this, Braids deck, like the blue Braids, that basically is the one that allows each player to put stuff onto the battlefield for free. Like, it's a very bad commander, because basically you're allowing everyone to do it before you get a chance. Mm-hmm. And so I run a good amount of steel effects in the deck. And I mean, I have to say that in my experience, I've never encountered a huge amount of hate, like, in my usual playgroups for these effects. But I have to say that, I mean, online I've seen some people that feel really strongly about it. I remember once there was this person that, like, said, oh, if someone tries to steal one of my cards, I'm gonna scoop. So, but yeah, but I have to say that personally, my experience hasn't been so bad. Like, usually, and what about you guys?
I know, like, I have friends who absolutely hate stealing. I actually made a Zara Renegade Recruiter list, which is one of the Commander Legends, like, red-blue decks. But when I was building the deck, I knew that I played with people who would get very, very upset about that card. So I built the deck to not upset them as much as possible. And really what that meant was, like, not keeping things, like, finding other things to do with the creatures that I would steal, because how Zara works is when she attacks someone, you can look at their hand and play one of their creatures, and it's tapped and attacking the player too. So it's silly, it's fun, it's like a big effect on the game sometimes, depending on like how quick you can get Zara out or what's going on, but not crazy, right? But yeah, some people definitely react poorly to that kind of thing. And it's, I think like a primal thing, you know, like when we're kids and like you get a new toy and you're like, oh, I'm so excited to play with this. And then someone else like plays with it when you're not looking or something. That's like, that can be upsetting. And that's true of like adults too. Like if you bought a new car and then somebody like drives your car before you, you'd probably be kind of upset that like, hey, like I just spent all this money on this. Like I'd like to do it. I think that's kind of where it comes from. Like the expectations that you put on yourself compared to like the expectations of the reality of like what ends up happening in the game when somebody steals the thing. Like it's this mismatch there that people don't like.
I think it's also like a preventing access to my commander type of thing. Like, I mean, in Commander, a lot of people are building their decks with the assumption that they're always going to have access to their commander. And sometimes to the point where their deck just doesn't work if they don't have access to it. So I think that seeing something like a Gilded Drake in the 100 saltiest cards is it's kind of in the same genre as like, you know, Oko, which is in the top 100 cards, or something, or like a Drannith Magistrate, almost just preventing people from accessing the key card that their deck is built around is like really effective at preventing them from playing the game. And that's maybe what people are reacting to.
Yeah, absolutely. And for example, I mean, my favorite deck is my Meren deck, and I have been powering it down for a while and not playing it a lot because usually people perceive it as a bit strong. But for example, in that deck, it's a commander that's perceived as very strong. So, you know, people have a tendency to run their Oko or their Song of the Dryads or whatever to use them against my commander. And what I found that can help a lot is to build your deck in such a way that you're able still to, it's able to function also without your commander. So I would say a suggestion if you feel that in your playgroup people are, you know, preventing you from accessing your commander very often, maybe just try to build your deck in such a way that it can still function even if you don't have access to your commander.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something that I've had to really focus on the last few years, because spot removal has become so much more prevalent. I feel like, oh man, like I'm just not gonna be able to keep this around. That sucks. Yeah, I mean, I feel like we're...
Well, hold on. I just want to switch over to the other type of stealing. So this is like the Gonti type of stealing. Has anyone seen like a strong reaction to those types of effects? Like where you're playing opponents' cards out of their library, that kind of thing?
So on my side, once again, I have to say that in real life, it didn't. I don't know why, but like apparently, these kind of things in where I usually play are not perceived as super salty, maybe. But like, I haven't really seen strong reaction to these kind of cards. Once again, definitely online, I saw many people that feel strongly about that. For example, also about the new Ixel commander, as we were saying before, that it's like poison, but also plays cards from your deck. And some people were like, I absolutely hate it when people are playing cards from my deck. So it's definitely something that people feel strong about. But yeah, personally, yeah, I didn't have this experience.
Yeah, I think usually when I see Gonti like make people mad, or that like Praetor's Grasp or et cetera, like stuff like that, it's because people don't like the physical aspect of the card where, like, oh, you get to hold on to this, like, thing of mine now. Like, I do not enjoy that this is happening.
We have somebody in our playgroup who's notorious for, like, playing these types of effects and then forgetting to give the cards back at the end of the game.
Yeah.
Ooh, okay.
I mean, he's an honest guy. It's an honest mistake, but it is very annoying when that happens.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Yeah, and actually I was thinking about it. And, you know, Commander is a format in which people love to, like, bling their deck out and make them more personal, you know, get some super expensive foil cards, artist proof, and these kind of things. And then someone comes and starts touching your, like, $200 card. I wouldn't be upset personally, but I can understand how someone may be upset because of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also like the fact that a lot of these things exile them face down, like it is a little bit anxiety inducing, like to not know what card they have, and I worry, like, what if that's my Mana Crypt or something? What if that's my super blinged out Artist Proof or something? I think that feeling, that insecurity, definitely leads to some of the saltiness around these types of cards.
Yeah. And also there is, I was just taking a look at the top saltiest cards, and I think, is it possible? I think we are forgetting the saltiest type of these effects, which is the one that lets you play cards as you were, like, the opponent. So stuff like Mindslaver and Sand Triplets, they are much higher in the salt list than the cards that we just mentioned.
Mm.
So probably that's something that it's perceived as even worse. I can definitely understand probably why. What do you think?
That's a good thing to bring up. It's a combination of a couple things. It's like, you know, my opponent getting their greasy fingers on my cards. It's also like a time equity issue. Like, you're not just playing on your turn, you're playing on my turn too. And it's, you know, and it is, of course, terrible every time one of these things happens to you. Like, they often make you spend your resources to kill your cards. Like,
it's like a combination of all the feel bads that we mentioned previously.
Yeah, so I'm not surprised to see those cards so high up in the salt scale, for sure.
Keep on moving, keep on going through salty cards.
So we mentioned, you mentioned before that Gilded Drake is one of the most hated steel effects. Mm-hmm. So, and this brings us back, I think, to another point that we slightly touched on before. So that the saltiest counter spells are also the most expensive ones. And Gilded Drake is one of the most expensive steel effects and one of the most powerful also. So, yeah, once again, I see a pattern.
All right, so one common theme that comes up a lot in the 100 saltiest cards is the dollar value of cards. So there's a lot of cards on there that aren't significantly different in terms of their mechanics from non-salty cards. But it's likely just the price tag that's leading them to get so salty. So, for example, Mana Crypt is not hugely different from Soul Ring, but Mana Crypt does show up in the top 100 saltiest cards, and it appears to be the cost that is causing this. So, do you all have a little insight into why it is that expensive cards tend to create more salt? I'm curious about, like, what kind of reactions you've seen when you drop your $100 card, $200 card, $1,000 card.
Yeah, so, I mean, first of all, I should say, I mean, I don't have a huge number of those, but I have some expensive cards. Like, for example, I have a Survival of the Fittest. And yeah, I've seen that the reaction when you drop them is just that people are like, oh, like, we're playing CEDH, I didn't know, oh, what's that? Yeah. And to some extent, I can understand, because this is the usual, you know, the pay to win feel bad. So mm-hmm. like you have the feeling that your opponent is just is beating you because they have more money. Which, strangely enough, I think it's something that probably comes up more in casual Commander, because in CDH, usually the community is super proxy friendly. Mm-hmm. And also in my personal experience, I played some paper CDH, and usually people have zero issues letting you run proxies. But yeah, I think in this case, it's the simple fact that you feel like you're losing because your opponent put more money in the game.
This is a problem that's gotten like a lot worse in the last few years, where like I've seen both sides of it. I've seen people be like, oh, you're playing like this land. Oh, I wish I could play that land. But I've also, like, we have a friend who has decks where he tries to play as many reserve list cards as possible in them. And something about the reserve list is that, like, there's a lot of clunkers on the reserve list. So if what's the star? Like
Wood Elemental?
No, yeah, Wood Elemental, definitely. There's like
not far off from that.
Yeah, I think it's not Celestial Prism. There's a card where you can like redirect damage.
Nova Pentacle.
Nova Pentacle, yeah. So let me just
throw all the discard.
Yeah, oh, yeah. There's not a reason for you to know it, I'll say that.
Yeah, so Nova Pentacle is a 4-mana artifact. It's 3 and a tap to activate. It says the next time a source of your choice, the Oracle text says the next time a source of your choice would deal damage to you this turn, that damage is dealt to target creature of an opponent's choice instead. So, you know, expensive card for what it does. It's on the reserve list. But like, no one typically gets upset when this person is dropping a Nova Pentacle. It usually tends to be like the Gilded Drakes. It usually tends to be the
cards that are good and expensive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And I think, you know, I had a discussion about this on Twitter like for a couple of days. And I think I asked something like, so I asked different questions. And one of these questions was, do you take money into account when you determine if a deck is casual or not? And a lot of people said yes. I think it was the majority of people. And then I think another discussion was about Mana Crypt, the card that Nick brought up before. Because, like, for me, I feel that, as Nick said, like, there is not a huge difference between Mana Crypt and Sol Ring. But, like, you just go around and ask, you know, casual EDH players, and they will tell you, you know, that Mana Crypt is a try-hard card, it's a CDH card, it's not a casual card. If your deck has Mana Crypt in it, it's not casual. But it's really weird, because it's the same power level, basically, as Sol Ring. But just the fact that Sol Ring is in every precon, it means that it's perceived as, you know, a perfectly fine card in casual.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the perceptions that people have based on like accessibility are, I think, definitely something that it's worth talking about, because exactly like you said, like, there's a lot of cards that are absolutely just like heinous power, like way over the top if you like stop for a second to think about them. But everyone has it, so it doesn't matter. Like, I would say, like, even an Arcane Signet is like pretty close. Exactly. To the, like, you know, like something where now it's so ubiquitous that people don't think about it, but the fact that it exists has like changed the format forever, you know? Whereas like something like a Force of Will, if someone Force of Wills your spell, you go, oh, it must be nice to have like whatever, like $80 now or something, you know? It's a lot different reaction. And I think it might just be the... It's something psychological in that, like, oh, I would play that too if I could, but I can't, you know?
Yeah. And my stance on this is basically that, like, if you are matching the power level of your group, and like everyone's kind of on board with, okay, we're all going to play this style of deck, then just go crazy. I don't care how much money you put into it. Because in a lot of cases, I think that expensive, powerful cards can often subsidize decks that couldn't otherwise hang with a certain power level. Like if you're building an extremely weak niche archetype, like I'm, you know, trying to do Thrall Tribal or something, then it would make sense that you would add a bit more power to the non-thematic cards in the deck in order to be able to hang with a pod full of sevens. So I think that like you can't really make a hard and fast rule like this staple automatically makes it CEDH, because there's lots of ways to use it as a tool to expand the viability of archetypes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, I mean, I definitely agree with this point. For example, I usually tend to stay away from super staples just because personally, you know, I find them a bit too strong for my usual playgroup and they are like a bit boring for me personally. So, for example, I don't know, my Rhystic Study and my Vampiric Tutor are sitting in my binder. But but in for example, I have a Doran Treefolk Tribal deck. And I think it's one of the decks where I run, you know, the most staply cards like Flawless Maneuver and this kind of Achromas Wheel, which, I mean, was not super expensive at the beginning, but now I guess it is. Because it's just that that type of deck needs all the help it can get to really do something. And so, yeah, you maybe see some money card, but the deck would not be able to do much without those cards at the usual power level I play at. And on the opposite side of the spectrum, I can guarantee, you know, to the listeners that you can build, you know, $100 Urza deck or some budget Godo CEDH deck or even Winota, and completely wreck a casual table with a budget deck. So yeah, the two things don't really go together, not all the time at least.
Yeah, I've definitely put decks together that were like janky, but the price was high because maybe it had like a recent example is I made one of the choosers. I made I cannot remember their name now. It's the dragon, the blue dragon where dragons and artifacts have flash. And Folk Hero, which is one of the commander deck backgrounds where once a turn when a creature enters the battlefield that shares a type with your commander, you draw a card. So I was like, oh, I'm gonna make like dragon, like Azorius dragons basically. And so that deck ended up having like a crap ton of money in it, right? Like the Azorius dragons that are good are expensive and artifacts that are good are expensive and things that give flash are expensive. And I just have gotten run over every single time I've played this deck. Like it is one of the worst win rates of my newer decks in the arsenal at this point. But if you look at the deck list, it's like very expensive. And these are all cards I've had for like a long time or like was lucky to open, et cetera, whatever. But, definitely the price did not correspond to the power level there, where I also just made another deck like that Zara one where it's running like just kind of a lot of other just jank, and the deck I think is probably like maybe $200 and it's like has a very high win rate, you know, like very, very different experience. So it really does depend on what you're doing with it. I think the idea that I think people correspond like high price tag to lots of staples and things when that's really not necessarily the case. It's all like everything in Commander, it's all context dependent. Like the reason seven doesn't mean anything is because like in one play group, seven could mean like we're playing with Grim Monoliths and comboing really fast. In another group, it means I'm playing my Lin Sivi, like Rebels deck, you know? So it's all just dependent. It's really,
You know, if you really think, still that, you're not convinced, you know, that you really need the money to make a deck strong. I think it was on maybe Playing with Power or some of the one of the CDH YouTube channel. They have a lot of gameplay videos with budget CDH decks that are built like using $100 or something like that, or even less. I don't remember. And those are decks that kill you on turn three. And they are budget decks. So like, go take a look and you will see that, you know, even with a very tight budget, you can make super strong decks that would just wreck most casual tables.
Yeah. I don't play CDH mostly, but I do love their videos a lot. I think it's like a really good like intro to that part of the format, like the CDH community, but also like can show you what it's all about, like that it's not really just a bunch of people being like really sweaty sitting at a table. It really is still about like having fun and like playing Commander. So absolutely. Yeah, definitely recommend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it can also show to players who are kind of new to the format what actual CDH is, because you know this comment yeah. that you get all the time is like, oh, your deck is CDH because maybe, I don't know, you have a slightly tuned Meren deck or whatever. That's not it. And, you know, you can just go check what people actually play at those levels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Do we have anything else we want to say on the subject of money cards? Because there's one other, like, not quite archetype, but like style of deck that I think gets an inordinate amount of hate that I wanted to touch on. So I think this is a little similar to, in fact, that we started off the episode with. And these are decks that like massively screw over one player. And I'm thinking like Blim, Comedic Genius, and Zedru the Greathearted, this style of deck where you hand somebody a poison pill, and then it just like either kills them or greatly reduces their ability to play the game. And so I think that these types of decks draw a lot of hate because everyone thinks that like they are going to be the person who gets screwed. But as someone who's like played Zedru the Greathearted, played Blim, Comedic Genius, I can tell you that there just aren't enough booby prizes out there. And like the process for giving them away is like slow or fragile. And so really like I'm the decks are not that good at screwing over a lot of people in quick succession. And it's similar to Infect in that if you have the ability to steer the Blim player or the Zedru player in a certain direction or make a deal with them, like, hey, how about you give them the Forbidden Crypt or whatever, and I won't kill your guy. That kind of thing can actually increase your ability to win the game because you're eliminating other play, or you're allowing them to eliminate other players who could threaten you potentially. And of course, by not having to spend a removal, you're making it so that you then are in a better position once you get to the finals with this Blim or Zedru player.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree. I think they fall in the kind of the same category, broadly speaking, as Infect, where someone is targeted first and they die first. And and you don't want to be that person. And so this causes some kind of strong reaction. What can I say is that in my experience, like, I never met a Zedru or Blim deck that was actually trying to do that. And the only Zedru deck that I met was a friend's deck. And actually what he was doing was Voltron Zedru, basically enchanting Zedru with all kind of auras, and then he would gift the auras to you, but they would remain attached. They would remain attached to Zedru, so you would draw cards, but basically nothing would have changed, and then it would beat you down with Zedru. It was a pretty cool deck, I have to say.
That's funny.
Not a huge win rate, but really, really fun.
Yeah, that's fun. That's cool. At this point, like, we've covered a lot of material. Do you have like any last thoughts on the episode today?
Yeah. So I wanted to maybe close the episode by, you know, saying who is the real threat? Because like we said, you know, many of these archetypes, they have some undeserved hate. And in my experience, what I've noticed is that it happens too often that you have this deck at the table who's like doing nothing but drawing cards and ramping for the first turn of the game, the first turns of the game. And they always have like a full grip of cards and they're not doing much. And like, I noticed that they don't get as much attention as they would deserve, in my opinion. In some way, like, you know, some aggressive infect creature on the table attracts much more attention than someone with 10 cards in their hand and like, you know, who ramped four times, which is pretty wild to me because I would be much scared of the second person than the first. And I even noticed that this works very well for me personally. So some of the decks that I play that are the most successful are decks that do exactly this. Just ramp, draw cards, and then either drop some huge A-makers or some combo and close the game out of nowhere.
I think I have a guess for like why this is able to fly under the radar. Because like, I mean, greatly increasing like your resources should trigger alarm bells for people, but I think people are a lot more worried about losing their ability to play the game and having opponents interact with their permanents and like disrupt their game plan. I think people come to the commander table because they want to do the thing. And so they're going to react strongly to like, oh, you milled the cards I needed to do the thing, or, oh, you're going to infect me out and I'm going to die before I get a chance to do the thing. So I think it sort of makes sense. Like most people come to a commander table knowing that they've got at best, or rather they should expect to win only a quarter of the games. And so I think people are less focused on who will actually win the game and more like, can I just derive my satisfaction from doing my thing rather than being the one person who makes it to the end? And so like, you know, the type of deck often green or green X that is able to just ramp, build up my resources, but not stop you from doing your thing, and then I'm just gonna cast a Crater Hoof or cast a Triumph of the Hordes and close out the game that way. It's so funny that like nothing they've done up until that point draws any hate, but you will see like the win condition they selected end up on the 100 saltiest cards. Like you're gonna see Crater Hoof Behemoth in the 100 saltiest cards. You're going to see Triumph of the Hordes in the 100 saltiest cards. And nobody's thinking about the fact that like, well, they can't really win with Crater Hoof if you didn't let them build up a board full of creatures, or same with Triumph of the Hordes. It's the win condition's fault, not everything they did up until that point, which is kind of funny to me.
Yeah, I think this is a good point. I mean, what you say about the fact that people come to a commander game to do the thing, so that is what, in some sense, what you're saying is that as long as I get to do my thing, I don't care if after I've done it, I die, I'm happy anyway. I think, I mean, this in my experience can become a problem when you have kind of a regular play group in which someone is, you know, defaulting to this kind of strategy. So we had like this Windgrace player in our play group who was like winning a lot of games. Exactly because of that, because I think for some time we didn't really realize that if we were spending like a lot of time just ramping the whole game, it didn't mean that, you know, it didn't deserve some attention. So if you're playing in a regular playgroup, it can become a bit tiring to often die to the same strategies.
Yeah, absolutely. Like there's the one player who... has the one win condition in their deck and you keep seeing the one thing, then that'll get old much faster.
Yeah. And it takes some conversations with your play group to say like, hey, I know it doesn't look very scary right now, but this person is going to win the game. They're going to eventually be so far ahead that they can just play their combo or their win condition with protection, and then we all lose. And it takes a little bit of political skill to get everyone on the same page and thinking about like long term how the game is going to play out, rather than like, boy, that swamp mosquito sure is scary.
Yeah. Well, cool.
Yeah, I think we're at the end of the episode here. Does anyone have any other final thoughts they want to share on everything we covered today?
Oh, no, personally, I'm happy with what we covered, and I think it's been a really interesting discussion with you guys.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. Thanks for suggesting the topic. We're trying to fit in some more collaborations this year. We're trying to fit in more, as much like different content between spoiler seasons as possible. So this was great. Really glad to have you on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Really, really happy about it.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's been fantastic having you on. And I agree that this was a really interesting discussion. So again, how can people find you if they want to continue the conversation, Valerio?
So I'm mainly active on Twitter at @GolgariGuy. And you can find me there. And I usually, you know, discuss about mainly Commander, but sometimes other MTG related topics.
Excellent. Well, definitely encourage all of our listeners to check out your account. I think you have really good discussions there all the time. And again, appreciate you coming on the show. It's been wonderful, and you're welcome back anytime you'd like to.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been great.
Well, everyone, thanks for listening. We're going to wrap it up here. But let us know what you thought of this episode, and we'll talk to you in the next one. You can reach out to me on Twitter. I'm at Commander Theory.
And on Twitter, I am at Fat Bartleby.
You can also email us at commandertheory@gmail.com. Our theme song is Lincoln Continental by Nick Cage. You can check him out on SoundCloud.
And if you're interested in some other creative projects I'm working on, I have a band you can check out. We are a pink punk, pop punk band called The Have Nots, all one word, like cosmonauts. You can listen to all of our music for free right now. You can just head over to thehavenots.bandcamp.com. That is thehavnauts.bandcamp.com. And check us out. Let me know what you think.